Shed.
There's a surprise at the end of this podcast, and if you were listening to the end of yesterday's podcast, then you'll have a pretty good idea what it is. But I'll just say this: if you're a fan of Star Wars, you'll want to stick with this one. Let's open the door.
So I'm Alfie Wern. I'm a PhD student at the University of Bristol, and I'm working on a dementia research project. We are trying to develop tests or improve tests which can help to diagnose dementia much, much earlier than we currently can. So at the moment, we have to sort of wait until the symptoms have become quite bad and people can't really remember anything or retain new information for very long before we can give it any accurate diagnosis and say that's Alzheimer's disease. This is sort of how we treat it.
And why is it important to get it early?
So what it does is it breaks down the brain. It causes parts of the brain to sort of die, and that's as far as we know, that's quite irreversible. So if we can spot it before the brain degenerates, basically, and before the memory symptoms get bad, then we might have some hope of developing treatments which can stop it getting worse and therefore improve prognosis for people.
I mean, when you say early, how early do you think you can start to detect signs of it?
Well, as early as possible is what we're hoping. So there's about 20 or maybe even, 30 years or so where stuff is happening in the brain before you actually get a presentation of symptoms. Plaques are made of a protein called amyloid, which build up around cells, and they're toxic to the brain cells and they cause them to die. That amyloid protein, that builds up in those decades leading up to it, and we think that triggers a sort of cascade which might cause further degeneration. There's another protein as well called tau, which like tangles up inside the cells, which does a similar thing and also starts to cause damage to the brain. Maybe by detecting those things, we can identify it very early on.
And would they manifest in people's behaviour at that point, or not really?
Well, not in the behaviour that we're testing for at the minute. So at the moment, the memory tests which we use are not particularly sensitive to. They can tell when someone's got severe impairment. But we haven't developed them to be sensitive enough to identify really subtle changes in memory, which is one of the things that I'm doing in the PhD, is I'm trying to sort of refine the cognitive tests which we use to make them a bit more sensitive to damage to areas of the brain which are damaged at the earlier stages.
Okay, right. First, before we go any further, I'm going to declare an interest, which is my father has dementia.
Okay, yes.
And he, I would say 2 or 3 years, he was showing severe memory issues, and I was trying to get him to go to the doctor. He wouldn't go. Right, I'm not asking you to solve that problem.
Big ask.
Yeah. And have you got a time machine? And massive
working on it.
Massive persuasive powers. Then that'd be great. but one of the things is really astonishing to me is that the tests that we've got at the moment didn't pick up that he had dementia. To me, as his son, I could see a severe change in him. But the tests that he was doing were showing that he had mild cognitive.
Yeah.
I was having conversations with him where I was saying to him, do you think it's a bit strange that you can't remember my birthday? And he would say, well, I know that it's in the summer. And I would say, okay, but don't you think that that's a bit strange that you, well, I know it's in June or July.
Yeah.
And, he's had a hugely successful career, an incredible brain. You could ask him any score from any cricket match from about 1950 to today, and he'd be able to tell you who it was and who'd got the wickets.
Yeah.
And he can't remember his son's birthday. And the tests are not picking up that he's got dementia. So we've got a long way to go from the tests that there are at the moment. How are you improving it? How are you trying to improve it?
Well, there's two things there that come out of that, really. The first of which is, although when people see clinicians and they see their GP, they take a history and they'll listen to what they have to say, but the cognitive tests which are used, the sort of objective measures of how good is your memory, they don't take into account any sort of previous performance. And it's possible that even though compared to how he was before, he might still be functioning, or it seems that he was functioning at a level good enough to not get the sort of lower scores, which are on a borderline of saying this person has dementia, and rather fall into that window of having, quote, mild cognitive impairment, which a lot of people do fall into. They don't pick up the previous baseline. The other thing is something called cognitive reserve, which sort of leads into that, actually, but is the idea that if you have, say, more years of education, or you know, you've used your brain a lot, or you've learned a lot, and you've built up a lot of resistance to damage. So this is why people with more years of education have, I believe, it's lower incidence of getting dementia or of being diagnosed with dementia, because they have that cognitive reserve. It sort of acts as like a buffer. Right. You can lose more brain tissue, or you lose more function before you lose sort of daily independence and actually become severely become qualified for a diagnosis of dementia. Mm. Yeah, he may well have sort of declined a lot. That is obvious to his friends and family, but like I say, on the objective tests, that might not have shown up. So that doesn't actually answer your question at all. You said, what are we actually doing to refine the tests? Well, one of the first parts of the brain to be damaged is the part of the brain that makes memories last for a long time. It's called the hippocampus, and studies have shown that without it, or with severe damage to that area, you struggle to make memories last for any more than, you know, a few seconds if you don't have it at all. So the current tests, what they do is they sort of test memory over maybe half an hour, up to half an hour. And if you can't make memories last for that long, then we say, okay, that's probably, maybe you've got some hippocampal damage. Let's give you an MRI scan and so on and so on. Maybe you've got Alzheimer's. What my tests are doing differently is that we're actually saying, well, half an hour might not be long enough. And we're testing at a much later time point to see how long can people retain these memories for. So if I test on the scale of days or weeks, is that going to be more sensitive to damage to the hippocampal area? And therefore, is that going to be more sensitive to identifying sort of the earliest signs of neurodegeneration and earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease?
Mm-hmm. Okay. How's it going?
Well, I don't know yet, because at the moment we've tested a whole group of kind volunteers to the study, and we've seen how they are at one point, at point A, and now we're going through all the follow-up visits. So everyone's coming back after a year, and we're going to see how they've changed, and or whether or not they have changed. Some of them may have stayed the same, some of them may even have got better. And then we use the sort of baseline tests that we did to see if we can predict that change. So I've not looked at those results yet, so okay. I don't know. Ask me again in a few months' time.
Okay, maybe we'll do that.
Yeah.
But what? So why would they get better?
Memory problems can be caused by a huge variety of things, and people, a lot of people with a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment will go on to get Alzheimer's, but that's only about half of them actually will. The other causes of, you know, might not be due to dementia at all. Might be due to stress or the side effects of a medication that they're taking, or a stroke perhaps, or, you know, so any number of factors, or just like transient anxiety on the day of testing, something like that. And then when you test them again later, that's all passed. We want our tests to be sensitive to picking up that sort of hippocampal damage, so that they're sort of specific to Alzheimer's disease, or at least specific to dementia.
Mm-hmm. Because the thing is, with my dad, for example, where he was, I could tell that he had what seemed to be dementia of some sort, some sort of severe mental problems. But why would it actually matter now for him to get that diagnosis? Are there things coming down the line which might be, it's worthwhile you doing this, is really what I'm
saying. It's true that there are no, quote, disease-modifying therapies for Alzheimer's disease at the moment, which means that there's nothing which actually stops the degeneration happening in the brain. There are medications which can sort of boost memory and sort of counteract that neurodegeneration for a bit, but they sort of only work, they work quite well in most cases, in some cases, but they don't work forever. So there are no disease-modifying therapies at the moment. But if you look at clinical trials, for example, we need to be able to test all, there's I think 400, probably more than that now, 400 final stage clinical trials which have tried drugs to treat Alzheimer's disease, but they've failed. And they might have failed. One of the reasons for that is that they might have failed because we're only testing them on people who've already got dementia or who have already got severe neurodegeneration. So if people organising a clinical trial can identify a group of people who we can say accurately that they're probably going to get Alzheimer's disease, or that they'll probably experience the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease in 5, 10, even 15 years, then we can test new drugs on these people, or even retest some of the old drugs that we think have failed, test them on this group of people, follow them up over time and see how they develop if you treat it much, much earlier.
Mm.
And so you actually increase the likelihood of being able to develop those drugs.
Okay. But why are you doing this? What's your personal motivation for this?
So somebody asked me this the other day, and it's a slightly strange one, because actually I don't have any personal experience without, like, touch wood, and, you know, I'm very lucky to say that.
Mm.
I don't really have any personal history with it. I don't want to pretend that I'm doing out the kindness of my heart or any of that. I like science and I like research, and I wanted to do a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a PhD course where I got to try some different projects, and I liked the work of this one. I liked interacting with patients and with volunteers on a day-to-day basis, rather than doing other types of sort of lab-based research, which I'd done before, and I quite enjoyed that. But then when I got to work with people, I enjoyed that much more. So it's sort of from a nerdy perspective rather than a sort of emotional perspective, I guess. But
yeah. That's a good motivation.
I think so, yeah.
That's pretty cool. So what are you... if you weren't doing this, is there anything else that you'd be like, I really wish I was studying the supermassive black hole at the centre of the galaxy?
I mean, yeah, so I had the best GCSE physics teacher. When I was 15, 16, doing my GCSEs, I was convinced I was going to do physics. And I was, you know, we did cosmology, and I was fascinated by it all, and it was great. And I had, you know, Mr. Tooley, his name was.
Mm-hmm.
He was an inspiration to me when I was that age. I then did physics as an A-level, as is the logical next step, and it was rubbish and I hated it.
Oh, really?
Because, yeah, I think it was because I liked the cosmology stuff. And that was all in the second year, the sort of A-level year rather than the AS year. And we did copper wire tensions and how long does it take this tennis ball to fall, which is, you know, fine, important stuff, but mix it in with a bit of space and I would have been sold. But had the dice fallen differently, then maybe I would have done something like that, because it does still fascinate me. But now, just from a layman's perspective,
you're in the middle of a PhD at the moment. Can you see beyond it? Do you know where you want to go?
I'd like to stay in science, I think. Every time I think of alternative jobs or other things that I'd want to do, like teaching or... that's one. like teaching, then you know, I tried it for a bit and it was all right, but there's something about science which is... There's a certain amount of freedom which you get. Maybe I just get that in my lab at the moment, I don't know. I it's by no means perfect, and the academic environment is very far from perfect in many ways. So I think I'll try it for a bit.
Yeah.
And then I'll see how I feel. Yeah, I mean, brains are what I do. I started sort of liking psychology, and then following people like Derren Brown, you know, I was that sort of pop psychology crossed with magic and all that. I became fascinated with. In fact, I think I probably owe it to him. As you know, I read a book called The Neuroscience of Magic, or my mum bought me that book. I think that's when I started following neuroscience, whilst I was fanatical about people like Derren Brown. I thought, well, okay, I want to know how brains work.
Yeah.
And 7 or 8 years down the line, I still don't know how brains work, but we're working on it.
Yeah. I think that's just the thing. It's a fairly common thing, right, for people who love cosmology to also love what's going on in your brain.
Yeah, well, it's a different, you know, the opposite end of the scale, really, isn't it? It's sort of the opposite end of the scale from a biologist's perspective. I guess you've got space and cosmology on one end, and atoms and quarks on the other end, and then in the middle you've got this hugely complicated, gooey, evolved computer that's the most complex machine in the universe.
Yeah, there's a
brackets
book
that we know
coming
of.
Out. I interviewed for the Physics World podcast. I interviewed Amanda Gefter, who wrote a book called Trespassing on Einstein's Lawn, which is about people like me, or pretending to be part of the science world, so by being a science communicator, getting to trespass on Einstein's lawn. Because her next book is it's about the connections between our brains and the universe, right?
Mm.
And it seems like it's a really dangerous place to go if you're in the science world. I mean, if you're Deepak Chopra, then that's the right place to go, right? Because you can make stuff up and make money out of it. But if you want to find the reality of that, it feels like a really dangerous place to go. And she's determined. Anna's written the books. It'll be coming out at some point next year, I think. But she's written this book which explores the scientific connections between our brains and cosmology, which is, I mean, I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean by science should be open to everyone, right? And not just scientists who like me, who have their tiny, tiny niche and they've learned the dogmas of the research and the academic environment. People can be so much more creative than that, right? And get so much more from it. And if you think a little bit wider, then you get things like that, I guess.
Are you a science fiction fan?
I'm a science fiction fan. Well, I say that. I'm probably not a very, very good science fiction fan compared to the likes of yourself, having a podcast on it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm partial to a little science fiction now and again. Doctor Who is my thing, if I have a thing. It's my thing. Okay, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, that's the sort of the main bit of sci-fi which I followed since Chris Eccleston and Russell T Davies rebooted the series in, 2004, I think.
And have you enjoyed all the incarnations over that time?
I've watched all the incarnations all the time. Oh, look, there's a TARDIS on your Christmas tree. Brilliant. That's not true. I have enjoyed all the incarnations. I think all of the actors and actresses have done a fantastic job. I think the writing has been shaky at times. But I think, I don't know if it's just nostalgia or if, you know, the days of Chris Eccleston and David Tennant were actually loads better. I think it's not got anywhere near as good as that since then.
Yeah.
I think Jodie Whittaker has done a fantastic job with the scripts that she's been given. I complain about it sometimes, but I still watch them every week, and I'll watch them and I'll enjoy them.
I know what you mean. It felt quite big. It felt quite kind of almost operatically big in those days, and it was really incredibly magical. And I don't know whether that's nostalgia, but I remember the excitement week on week that I had for that. And these days, it's more fun than excitement.
Yeah. It feels more sort of children orientated, which I guess it sort of is, which is fine.
It's supposed to be, right?
Yeah, right. It's a children's show, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
You know, stop being so analytical of it. But I watch the old episodes and it just feels a little bit less pantomimey.
Lyra wouldn't watch it; it'd be terrifying. But she's 7, right? But she's never seen Star Wars, which is okay because she's 7.
Yeah. Yeah, that's acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, you're waiting for the day, aren't you, when you can crack out Star Wars?
Yeah, we're talking about it a lot at the moment. She lives in this house, right? It's really hard to not be obsessed with Star Wars.
So she's obsessed with it, but doesn't have a clue what the...
She said to me, "Oh, it's really weird, Daddy. I really like Star Wars, but I've never seen it." I showed her the trailer. Somebody made like a modern trailer. And some of them are terrible because they're like real modern trailers in that they give you the whole story.
Sure, yeah.
But there was one that was really nicely done. And I showed it to her and she was like, "Oh, I'm so excited about that. But Darth Vader is terrifying."
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, he is. That's perfect.
That's sort of the point.
Yeah.
But I think she can handle it. I think I've not met her. I'm sure she can handle it.
she'll be fine once you do it. It's just I don't want to do it too soon and scare her off and then she'll, you know, be...
That's true. You don't want to overdo it.
I mean, there's definitely some she's not going to... I'm like, I can't show her Force Awakens. You can't see The Force Awakens until you've lived with Han Solo for a long time.
That's true, yeah, because then it's like, why is he old all of a sudden?
Yeah.
It's like, well, it wasn't all of a sudden.
Yeah,
it
was that incident on the bridge, which is, you know, so heartbreaking.
She won't be attached to it. You need to let her sit with it for 40 years.
Exactly.
Then one day, on her 50th birthday.
I tell you what was really exciting. We've got an interview with Lee Towersey, who is the man who controls R2-D2.
Amazing.
in all the films since The Force Awakens. And I think we'll put that on this episode at the end.
Fantastic. Yeah, I look forward to that.
Yeah. What else do you like then? You've got Doctor Who and Star Wars. Is there anything brain related?
I mean, yeah, anything that mentions neuroscience, I'm always there sort of critiquing it and looking and say, oh, is that possible? But a lot of it's done so artistically, you can't really. Things like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. That's not your classic sort of sci-fi, I guess, but it's addressing the topic of can you or should you erase memories from, you know, traumatic past or painful memories if you could, would you? And it's something which we're I don't think as anywhere near doing, but it's something really interesting to think about, and it's a fascinating film. I saw Inside Out. I was again analysing that one, and it shows mechanisms of memory storage quite nicely, where you have, I think, you have short-term memories which are then transported elsewhere into that big data storage facility, don't they? Which is sort of what happens in the brain, where your hippocampus sort of takes the new bits of information and maybe stores them for a bit, we think, and then as it becomes consolidated and becomes fixed in your memory,
yeah,
in long-term memory, then it gets stored in areas of the cortex and areas on the surface of your brain. So it does sort of transfer. There is a theory of memory consolidation which shows this memory transfer from hippocampus to cortex,
yeah,
which is sort of portrayed by these colourful orbs being transported down into the long-term memory storage, and when bits are damaged, you know, when bits get knocked down in Inside Out, then they lose those memories, and it goes into the abyss in between, and I guess that's sort of a metaphor or a simile for you know, degeneration perhaps or brain damage, where you lose that.
Yeah.
That bank of memories. In reality, we don't think, that you have one cell which represents a single memory. Probably. There is a sort of idea, it's called the grandmother cell. The Jennifer Aniston cell, as well, as the idea that if you've got one cell which responds to one particular random stimulus, for example, a picture of Jennifer Aniston, that was the experiment that was done. But in reality, you know, there's probably not a single cell or a single group of cells which you could delete in one place that would then cause you to completely forget one particular thing,
yeah,
like your grandmother or Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah,
which is great fun.
Springs to mind, definitely not science fiction. Is Still Alice? Did you see that?
I didn't see Still Alice. No, but people keep saying I should, and it's on my list. Yeah. I have got a list.
Have you?
Yeah, I've got a list on IMDb. Oh, so many things. I'll show you.
Yeah.
It's an extensive one, but Still Alice is on there. Black Mirror was another one. There's lots of memory stuff on there. The one which springs to mind is where they can you can replay memories. Right, I think they have these contact lens things or something where he's on the bus and he's had a stressful interview and he's replaying memories over it in his contact lenses, which you do anyway, right? When you've had an embarrassing situation or a stressful situation, you replay and you think it over and over again. Mm. But he's actually able to do that, and he's able to zoom in on bits and see every little detail. Mm. Probably isn't that good for him, right? And you know, he's having arguments with people, and they say, "I said this, no, you said that. Well, prove it." Okay, and they can project their memories onto the smart TV, and then you can check. There's benefits to that, I'm sure, but it gets. Well, that's why it's on Black Mirror, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because
it's
creepy as hell.
Yes, quite terrifying.
Yeah.
Just close enough to be utterly terrifying.
Exactly.
Inception is another one.
Oh, yeah, Inception. Yeah, dreams and implanting thoughts. That's... I mean, imagine if you could... Yeah, if you could just go into someone's... I just want to be able to record my dreams. I find my dreams, they're brilliant. They're fascinating. And if I could wake up in the morning and, you know, press record on the little machine next to my bed and just see what was going on, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Let alone if you could go into somebody else's and explore, you know, what's going on inside their head during the night is a terrifying and fantastic topic.
Yeah.
But
I've had some dreams recently, and they're all completely related to what has just happened just before I've gone to bed. So I saw The Crimes of Grindelwald.
Oh yeah.
And spent the night dreaming that I was riding a... Have you seen it?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, so I was riding a Kelpie all night, which was incredible, amazing. And then I watched Elf. And I was riding a narwhal.
Brilliant.
it's obviously a thing. I like to travel in water.
It's a recent... Well, it's replaying recent experiences. That's what happens. That's what... that's what dreams are for, in theory. They're to help consolidate memories from the previous day. So clearly your brain took that bit of information about narwhals and thought, that's useful, I'll remember that for later, because you never know.
You never know when you'll need to have a narwhal saying, hope you find your day. Yeah.
Well, you know, your brain is taking these bits of information, and one idea of dreaming is that it is letting you live out experiences so that you can practice them without them ever having happened to you. So now you are prepared in case that ever happens. If you encounter narwhals, you will know exactly what to do because your brain has kindly supplied you with that sort of level of practice needed.
Yeah.
But
we could probably talk all night, but let's not. And I did say that we'd have Lee Towsey, who is R2-D2. So let's do that. And I would say that if you have any doubts during this, this is genuinely an interview with Lee Towsey, and this is just the way that we've chosen to present it. So enjoy.
He's not joking, it's true.
So Ty met Lee Towsey at Comic-Con in Birmingham recently, where Ty was selling his book, and Lee said he'd do an interview for us for The Cosmic Shed, which is just wonderful. I mean, he's got the job that surely anybody in that line of work would die for, and it is controlling R2-D2. In all the films since The Force Awakens. Now, for whatever reason, Lee didn't want to do an interview direct with him, so we had to travel to a galaxy far, far away and a long time ago so I could talk to R2-D2 about Lee Towsey. How did you get the job?
He says a man called Oliver Steeples called him to ask if I could join him for a trip to Pinewood to explain how we built our droids. A few meetings at Pinewood Studios later, we had one which turned out to be a job interview, and we both left the meeting having been offered jobs with Neil Scanlan's CFX team.
Is there anything else that we can see you're working?
He says he doesn't get much time off. Oliver left after The Force Awakens, but Lee has continued to look after the R2-D2 and operating him on every film since. He built the ALT track droid seen in Rogue One and Solo. He is also part of a team assisting with many other builds, along with running regular maintenance on the droids to keep them as reliable as possible when on set.
Any funny stories or anything that happened on set when you were filming that you can share with us?
Oh dear, I'm afraid our little tin friend is not complying. He says he's signed NDAs.
Oh, fair enough, but do you have a favourite R2 moment from the films?
He says that one of his favourite moments was operating R2 on the Falcon during The Last Jedi. When they shot the scene where R2 wakes up and drives over to Master Luke to talk to him, it felt like a special scene at the time, and he feels like it turned out to be pretty good in the film. When they reached Master Luke, they switched out the three-legged remote control R2 for the two-legged version. Jimmy V was inside the two-legged R2 at the time, with Lee performing the head movement via remote control. R2 says people have asked him if the Leia projection was shot after Carrie Fisher's passing. It wasn't. They shot that before her death and was always meant to be in that scene. It turns out it was a nice nod to Carrie Fisher in her memory.
Thank you so much to Alfie Wern for talking to me and for performing the role of C-3PO in that. And thank you so much to Lee Towsey for the answers to the questions. I'll post Lee's full answers to those questions on the Cosmic Shed website, thecosmicshed.com. I don't know about you, but I fancy going to watch The Last Jedi again tonight. We'll see you tomorrow. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.